discuss something today. Interesting and very practical topic, a controversial one too. The only downside is that the bottom line guidance is not that clear. So the concepts are interesting, the values are interesting, but you're going to ask me what you should actually do. I'm not going to have a solid answer for you. And that is the question of buying Jewish, hiring Jewish, selling Jewish, you know, preferring Jews over non-Jews when doing business, when buying, when selling, when hiring. The main source for this is a verse in this week's parasha. As we'll see, it has a kind of less than settled development in the halacha, but you know, we'll go through the classic and some of the more modern sources, and we'll get a feel for the contours of this topic. Relevant, you know, here in town, things like Costco, Rosh Shalom's, and hiring Jewish contractors as opposed to non-Jewish contractors, mortgage professionals, doctors, anyone. So the discussion begins with a midrash in the Taras Kahn. The verse in question is toward the beginning of the parasha. The pasuk says, "V'chisimku memkar mimkar la misecha o kano miyada misecha al tonu ish es achiv." I think. So the literal reading of the verse is, "When you sell something, v'chisimku memkar la misecha, when you sell something to your fellow man." Or you purchase from your fellow, al tonu, don't cheat him, don't injure him. Tonu, ona, is a difficult word to translate. In biblical Hebrew, it means something like injure. The Torah actually says in Parashas Bahar twice, al tonu and lo tonu. Chazal interpret it to refer to two separate prohibitions. One is called onas mamon, injury, financial injury, which is understood by the Talmud to refer to various kinds of cheating, of underpaying for something, overcharging for something, failing to disclose a latent defect, and so on. The second one is a broader idea of what we call a no'as dvarim, which refers to hurting someone's feelings, humiliating someone, making him feel bad, reminding him of past misdeeds or embarrassing things. That's a no'as dvarim. This first verse, v'chisimkru mimkar la misecha, o kano miyada misecha, so that's what the verse literally means. When you do business with your fellow man, with your Jewish brethren, don't cheat them. Now, the Medrash, though, in Taras Kahanim has a drasha. It punctuates the verse slightly differently. V'chisimkru mimkar kama la misecha. When you sell something, when you make a sale, it should be, ideally, la misecha, toward your friend, toward your fellow Jew. Similarly, when you buy something, ideally it should be from a Jew. Okano kama miyada misecha. When you purchase something, it should be miyada misecha, from your fellow Jew. The Sifra goes on, the Taras Kahanim, number 1. The Psukim are talking about real estate, all these types of, you know, selling and buying real estate in Israel. Ein li ela karkos, that's the context of the biblical passage. How do we know even personal property, movable property? So there's a drasha, mimkar, anything, even personal property. This is the midrash of the Taras Kahanim, that when you buy or sell, it should be to and from Jews. Now, for whatever reason, this is not brought in Shulchan Aruch, not brought in the major sources of halacha. It's not in the Rambam, it's not in the Torah, it's not in the Shulchan Aruch, as usual. I know this not because I'm such an expert in those works, but because the later Acharonim have commented, they've pointed out, for some reason, this does not get codified in the major halachic sources. Nevertheless, it is assumed to be normative by many poskim in Tshuvah Svarim and other halachic works. The first and foremost source that discusses it is a very, very famous tshuva of the Ramah. Papers and law journals have been published about this tshuva. I was reading one of them by Natanel, and Professor Natanel, writing about, that's the last name, writing about this case. This was a case that was put to the Ramah by the Maram of Padua, Rav Meir Katzenellenbogen. He was publishing an edition of the Rambam, the Yad HaChazaka. Now, in those days, it was apparently against the law for Jews to publish Svarim. Italy, the church didn't allow it. Jews had to partner with Christian printers to publish Jewish books. The Christians, of course, generally were not experts in rabbinic Hebrew. They used to hire a crew of Jews, proofreaders, editors, to do the work, but they would have the license. They would take part of the profits. So the Maram Padua, or Mayor of Padua, joined in partnership with a printer, a fellow named Alvis Bragadini. I'm probably not pronouncing that quite correctly, but that's what it looks like when you spell it out in English. He was printing this edition of the Rambam with the Rampadawas. The Rampadawa did a lot of critical work, manuscripts, and he made emendations. He tried to establish an authoritative text. He added some sources. He added notes of his own. He did apparently a good job on the Rambam. Now, this Bragadini had an enemy. He was challenging an existing printer who had a kind of preeminence back in Italy back then in Venice. This was a fellow named Giustianini. Certainly not pronouncing that one correctly, but something like that. This guy was really upset that someone dared to challenge his printing preeminence. So he decided to produce a competing Rambam. He ripped off some of the Rampadawa's work. He did his own Rambam. He stole some of his material, some of his editing work. It's not clear how much he benefited from the fact that he had done the work, but in any event, he produced a knockoff Rambam. He sold it at a major loss, at much less than the original Rambam was. That we don't have the exact facts and exactly what the prices were and a breakdown of cost and profit, but the accusations, at least presented to the Rama, was that it was being sold at an untenable price solely for the purpose of harming the first printer, who he was out to take revenge on, to financially injure. A zohov less, one gold coin less than the first Rambam, which apparently is a substantial amount, sounds like a substantial amount less. And he was going to seriously injure the financial prospects of the first printer and the Maran Padua, who apparently had invested significant sums in this first Rambam too. So the Maran Padua turned to the Rama. Now, obviously, the printers weren't going to go to a Dintara. The Christian, Patrician, Venetian printers weren't going to Basden. But what the Maran Padua wanted was he wanted the Rama to issue an injunction. The market here, obviously, was Jews. He wanted the Rama to issue an injunction that Jews should stay away from the second Rambam that was being illegitimately produced. He wanted Jews to be compelled, to be ordered, to purchase the first Rambam. And the Rama agreed. The Rama acceded to this request, issued a long formal ruling in favor of the first Rambam, barring Jews from purchasing the second Rambam. This was a major tshuva. It's quoted in various contexts in Chosh and Mishpat. It was a precedent-setting tshuva in several areas. The main one, which you'll see it quoted most often in context of, is the question of competition, illegitimate predatory competition. It's one of the, also copyright, it's kind of one of the central tshuvas in these areas. We're going to discuss, though, a much less discussed corner of the tshuva, where he makes an additional argument which is relevant to our discussion. The Rama writes, there are four reasons why Jews should prefer the first Rambam, the Maran Padua's Rambam, and one of the four reasons is, based on this midrash of the Taras Karnim, the idea that a Jew has a mitzvah where possible to purchase products from Jews and not non-Jews, where that's a viable alternative. Therefore, he says, since the Maran Padua's Rambam was available, even though it was more expensive, the Rama spends a while, and this is where the whole controversial part of the discussion comes in, obviously, the Rama spends a while, we're not going to get into the intricacies of his analysis, the Rama spends a while trying to prove to his satisfaction, to the reader's satisfaction, that this mitzvah of the Taras Karnim to prefer Jews applies even in cases where the Jewish product is more expensive. Now, the Rama does not give, and this is again going to be one of the key difficulties from a practical perspective, one of the key controversial points, the Rama does not give us that much guidance about how much more expensive does it have to be before we have an excuse to go, or right to go to the non-Jew. But he says, even if it's more expensive, and it sounds from his tshuva that it was a lot more expensive, he calls it a zohov more, and he describes in the course of the tshuva that if we don't issue a ban, nobody will buy the first Rambam because the price differential is so great and the first guy will be seriously injured. So he makes it sound like it was a major, major difference. Nevertheless, he says, the mitzvah to prefer Jews applies even in a case where the Jewish product is more expensive. And that's his ruling, and that is one of his various reasons, one of his various arguments for why Jews must buy Maran Padua's Rambam and not the competing edition of the Rambam.
So I'm just curious, for proponents of this opinion, would they distinguish among like necessities of life, food, clothes, stuff like that?
That's an interesting question.
It was a real burden, it could be a real burden.
That's an interesting question. There are certain halachas in general that the halacha wants to make sure that necessities are available and affordable. So, for example, there are anti-profiteering laws. The halacha is normally, halacha takes a native halacha, takes a generally laissez-faire approach that allows players in a market to set their own prices, profit at whatever level they feel is supportable without interfering. Halacha does have certain rules when it comes to staples, things like flour, oil, certain materials like that. there are certain regulations in how much you can profit. People often, we discussed Onah earlier, people often make a mistake. People often assume that Onah is some kind of price control. That's actually a conceptual error. The laws of Onah do not regulate pricing. What they regulate are deceptive pricing. They regulate pricing above or below the market price insofar as the other party to the transaction does not realize. If you disclose everything up front, if you clearly state the market price and saying, for whatever reason, I'm asking for more or I'm offering less, that's generally going to be fine. The Torah does not generally prohibit you from pricing at whatever terms you want, as long as there's full understanding by both parties. But when it comes to staples, we have what's apparently a rabbinic ordinance to prevent people from... There is discussion in some contemporary authorities on things like mitzvah, things you need for mitzvah, like esrog or matzah, about whether it's legitimate for a vendor to charge whatever the market will bear or whether some of these rules would apply. So there are certain rules that would that in general, Chazal certainly were sensitive to the idea that people had to be able to afford necessities. Whether this particular rule of preferring Jews would apply with regard to necessities, I don't have a direct source, and we'll see some of the case law and maybe it'll shed some light. I'll just, since you bring it up, I'll mention something that I certainly would not consider a necessity, but apparently some people have a different view of the subject. My favorite tshuva on this topic is a tshuva in the Sefer Tafos Re'im, in number 5. This is Rabbi Aaron Moshe Taubis, a 19th century Romanian authority in the city of Yass. I don't know how you pronounce that either. He was asked about a kind of kosher for Passover liquor. Apparently, the status quo had been there was some process by which, obviously the regular liquor was often problematic, the whiskeys, because they were produced from grain. So you had to look for substitutes for Passover. There was some process, which he doesn't explain exactly how it used to be made, which that was how things had been done in previous years. Now, there was a new process developed, which from his description is something, thank you to Wikipedia, we know is something called Tuzemak or Tuzemski rum, inland rum. This was a kind of rum-like beverage which was produced from beet sugar, not cane sugar from the West Indies, but it was produced from a byproduct of beet sugar. He describes it as mi syrup, samach yud reish vav pei. I think that's what it sounds like. Hanishar mi tzuker, hanas mi borekas. Borekas are beets. The syrup that comes from the sugar that came from beets. Basically, we know that to make spirits, you need some kind of sugar, which is then eaten by the little beasties and fermented into alcohol. So they had this new technology to produce this tuzemak. This was much cheaper than the old process, and the problem was that the people who had the factories, who had the facilities necessary for the production of this stuff, were non-Jews. They were non-Jewish industrialists. The stakeholders in the old system, people who merchants who had stockpiles of the old spirits, whatever they were Jews, who stood to lose a lot of money if the new stuff began to be available on the market. So again, they appealed for a kind of protectionist injunction that Jews should be required to buy their liquor instead of buying the new Tuzemak, which was much cheaper. He declined to issue this injunction. He makes several arguments. First, he expressly disagrees with Rama. He says that if it's going to be more expensive, there is no obligation of a Jew to patronize another Jew. The Rama is Tzarchian, and he says the Rama is of dubious normativity. Doesn't completely rule it out, but he says he's not convinced the Rama is correct. Then he makes a couple of other arguments, and we'll return to one of them later, but his third argument, my favorite argument, he says, in the last line or two on the first side of the page, he says, Balavachi says, if liquor is more readily available and is cheaper, this will result in more holiday cheer, more Simchas Yom Tov, because if liquor is expensive, many people can't afford it. And therefore, he says, we are not going to issue an injunction which will result in the minimization of Pesach spirit. No pun intended there, I'm sorry. And therefore, he's going to allow... So he's not even talking about what I would call a necessity, what you would probably call it. He's talking about liquor, and he fails even liquor because it's so important to have liquor for Yom Tov. He's not going to issue an injunction which would result in less liquor being available. So take that as you will. But again, so this kind of represents the two sides to the issue. The Rama rules that even that you have to prefer, there is a mitzvah, an obligation to prefer Jews even when it's more expensive, and apparently even when it's significantly more expensive. Others, such as Rabbi Taubes here, have argued that even if we accept the basic halacha as normative, it does not apply when the when the non-Jewish alternative is cheaper, certainly not if it's significantly cheaper. And that is kind of an unresolved dispute that goes down through the generations. So the quality of the product is something which arises in modern discussion. As we'll see, not going to see as much of as much satisfying material as we might like on that topic. But in general, I always point out, in addition to price, we would have, we can easily think of a half dozen or a dozen additional factors that would determine whom we patronize. So there's quality, as you said. There's convenience. One of my siblings was telling me about a case that's happening in her town where there's an existing kosher store, and they're about to have their lunch eaten by another store moving in. And one of the main attractions is that the parking situation is very difficult in the Frum store. It's, it's the parking lot is small, it's not convenient, the hours are not convenient, people come home from work, and the store's closed. So there's convenience, there's parking, there is you know, distance to the store. If the store is farther away, it takes more time to get there. Hassle, the speed of the checkout lines, the variety of the products, the courtesy and friendliness of the vendors. When you're dealing with service providers or professionals, you have questions like communicativeness. Does he return my phone calls? How is his professionalism? How is his reliability? Will he come when he says he's going to come? You know, I don't need to tell you. You can use your own imagination for all the different reasons we might have for preferring one over the other. There isn't actually that much literature about this stuff. We will discuss a couple of sources, which again won't comprehensively cover all these cases, but we will. But that is certainly a crucial practical point, and we'll try to return to it a little bit as we go.
Excuse me, how about the idea of competition? And you alluded to some extent, the idea of predatory pricing. But it didn't seem as though the commentary kind of focused on that.
So it actually does. I didn't get into that part of the tshuva. One of the main reasons, and the one that's much more heavily discussed actually in the Ramah's tshuva, what he argued that the Justi Anini Rambam was not legitimate because his predatory competition was out of bounds. He argued, now just to digress maybe slightly into that topic, it's a topic largely for a separate day, but the basic halacha of competition under Talmudic law and under rabbinic law still, that's pretty much carried down today, is that although there's some debate about it in the Talmud, the normative view, the dominant view in the Talmudic sugya is that competition is generally permitted. That generally it's a free country. A person has the right, free world. A person has the right to compete. A person has the right to open another store and let whoever ani osi b'toch shali, ata osi b'toch shalcha. I do mine, you do yours. So I can get whatever consumers I get. You can get whatever consumers you get. Halacha does not have a very protectionist system. However, the one major controversial exception, which is what many dinei Torah today revolve around, is the idea of destructive competition. If the newcomer if the situation is such that the newcomer will completely render non-viable the existing operator, then some poskim say that's prohibited. Poskim discuss different reasons why he would render the first one non-viable, either because he has structural advantages that allow him to price at a much lower cost. In the case of the Ramah, he didn't really have any actual advantage. His advantage was that he had deep pockets and was willing to eat a significant loss just for the purpose of revenging himself on his competitor. Sometimes they talk about economies of scale. They talk about other advantages having to do with tax rules and so on. So that this is what many dinei Torah revolve around, this doctrine. The truth is, this doctrine itself is controversial. Not all poskim accept it. The Chasam Sofer and many of his followers in the kind of the Hungarian European tradition were very staunch defenders of this rule, that halacha does not allow competition when it reaches that level of destructiveness, that there is a place for stability and for making sure that the current vendors remain viable. Other poskim take a much more laissez-faire attitude. They say there's no such thing. Halacha allows for creative destruction or whatever. The people have the right to compete, even if the market's not big enough for both players and one will go out of business. Deliberate loss leading for the purpose of driving out a competitor, some poskim explicitly disallow that. They argue that's midas dom. They argue that that's just vindictive. Again, it's not midas dom in the sense that you're doing it, nothing personal. You just want to corner the market so you can raise prices and make a fortune. Nevertheless, some poskim say that if your actual pricing is non-viable and your entire goal is to, certainly for revenge, but even if it's just to drive out a competitor, the Rav Post would disallow that, and that actually is the Ramah's main argument. The one that's more, or at least the one that's most widely discussed, is the idea that this was illegitimate or predatory competition. As I said, that's a topic for a different day. That he is the main source for this doctrine, although again he doesn't bring in the Shulchan Aruch, which is something that's an interesting point. So that's the main argument. But I'm trying to avoid those cases. I'm trying to assume that our discussion is focusing on cases where both stores are competing in a normal, profitable, sustainable way. Just that one of them is cheaper, perhaps a non-Jewish one, either because it's a larger store, economies of scale, or just whatever the reason is that they can afford to, that they choose to, or they can afford to price lower. So does that justify Jews going there? So that is basically a machlokes. The Ramah and those who follow him say that you still should or must prefer the Jew, even if it's more expensive, even if it's significantly more expensive. While others, like Rabbi Taubes, say no, this is not the halacha. Many poskim say you are not obligated to prefer the Jew if he is certainly significantly more expensive. You can look just as a kind of representative source here is the Chikrei Lev. Rabbi Rafael Yosef Chazan, a leading Sephardic authority from the turn of the 19th century or so, he acknowledges the fact that this halacha is honored in the breach. He says people do whatever they want. Merchants, nobody cares. Everyone just buys from wherever they want. They pay no attention to whether Jewish alternatives are available. It seems to be against the halacha. It's true. It's not on the Shulchan Aruch, he says, but it seems to be a pretty mainstream halacha. There's no real dissent. He goes back and forth. He tries to find justifications. He talks about the idea of cheaper, and he actually says that even if the non-Jew is cheaper, he says, ktsas, it's a little cheaper, he says, still... He says you still have to buy from the Jew, as long as it's not a large difference. Again, he discusses the idea of small difference versus large difference. He does seem to feel there's a difference between small and large differences. Again, uses the most vague, qualitative terms. Doesn't get into any numbers or any practical guidance. But he says you should prefer the Jew if it's a little more expensive, but not if the price difference is much larger. So let's turn to that question a little bit and discuss what exactly this would mean for the price difference to be large or small, and the short answer is that nobody really knows. The various poskim who discuss this question have various theories, various suggestions are made, but there is no consensus. There is no really solid standard for what's considered a large or small difference. The Chafetz Chaim is one of the main, most authoritative proponent to the view that there is a mitzvah, but that it stops when the difference is large. He brings the Ramah, but he says the Ramah can't possibly mean that you have an obligation to purchase from a Jew even if it's much more expensive. Again, we're not going to get into the technical details of his analysis, but he says it's clear that if there's a large difference, you cannot have an obligation to do so. He doesn't define large and small, but he makes the basic point. Now again, this is not in Shulchan Aruch, so you're not going to find this in the Mishneh Berurah. This appears in the Chafetz Chaim's work, Avas Chesed, which is a little work he wrote basically on the halacha and the hashkafa of interpersonal relationships. It has halachic material, it has, kind of Muslim material. He discusses this both in the halachic section of the work as well as in the more Muslim section of the work. The first point he makes, which is, I think, common sense probably indicates this, but he makes the point explicitly. He says that we began by quoting the Taras Kahneman, who says buying and selling, and extends it from real estate to personal property. The Chafetz Chaim assumes that it applies to service providers too. I've been saying that all along, but he makes the point explicitly. He says the same Torah that wants you to support Jews in buying and selling also wants you to support Jews in hiring. And he gives the example in the Musar part of the work. He gives the example of the wagon driver. He says it's a Musar has to be taken by many Jews who don't care at all. They'll equally hire. He talks about the Balagala, the famous Balagala of European folklore. They're just as quick to hire a non-Jew as a Jew. That's wrong. It's against the Torah. The Torah says that if there's no major price differential, you have to hire the Jew. And so that's, on the one hand, he does exhort you to follow this halacha and to keep it and even apply it even to services, he says. On the other hand, he's pretty sure that it does not apply to large differences. He's not even entirely clear. His language, even on the basic halacha, when there's not a huge difference in price, he's not even entirely clear or consistent whether he feels it's an absolute obligation or it's just a value. He switches between language of chiyuv and language of tov or mutav, he says. So, but he definitely feels it's a good idea, something that a God-fearing Jew should do. But again, he limits it to a case where the price difference is not that much. So how much is that much? So there are postkin who try to use fixed percentages, who try to argue that if the higher price of the Jew, now I keep using the word higher price when you're dealing with a vendor, which is the situation many of us will commonly face. The reverse would be true too. If you're trying to sell something and you're trying to sell a house or a car and you have two offers and the Jew is offering less than the non-Jew, the same thing would apply in reverse, although most of the literature has more to do with buying than selling. I guess that was just the more practical case they talk about. So some postkin try to use a percentage. Some posts can say a sixth. We find a 1/6, 16% or so, is a common figure used in halacha. The laws of Onah have the figure in. A sixth figures in certain contexts. Some posts can try to argue that it is a sixth. Other posts can really argue that it doesn't really make as much sense to use a fixed percentage. Other posts can argue intuitively it makes more sense to look at the impact on your bottom line. If I'm in the grocery, and I have two bags of barley. So first of all, I should mention, I've always felt for years that even if you're not dealing with two different vendors, you're dealing with one store, but they have two products. One is a Jewish product and one is a non-Jewish product. Again, putting aside the quality issue, which again, we'll return to maybe shortly, but assuming the qualities are equivalent or you don't care, and one is a Jewish product and one is not, I would argue the same thing would apply. Because again, ultimately the money is getting into the Jewish pockets. They can argue if they've already bought the product, if the Jew has already made the profit, it has no short-term immediate effect, perhaps, but in the long term, I'm sure there's an effect. If you keep buying, the Jewish stuff keeps getting sold, they'll buy more of it. But so again, if I'm buying a barley for $1 a bag from Goya and $1.10 or even $1.30 from Geffen, it's probably not going to make, even if I buy this several dozen bags a year, it's probably not going to make a huge difference in my bottom line for most of us. On the other hand, if you're buying a car and the car is, even if it's the difference between $10,000 and $11,000, that might be less than the sixth, but that's a big deal. $1,000 is something which for many of us is a big deal. So there are posts when we say that it doesn't really make sense to give a fixed percentage. We have to look in general terms as to how easily you can afford the additional price. And within this latter approach, that we look more at the impact on your bottom line and affordability, there are posts, can we say, who talk about the idea of aggregating transactions. So, for example, one contemporary author writes that if you're going to the grocery, on each individual product, the difference might be 50 cents or a dollar between, let's say, a Jewish grocery store and a non-Jewish grocery store. But if you're making a $500 order or a $1,000 order before Pesach, and the difference is a couple hundred dollars, so that could be a big difference. I even seem to have recall hearing years ago, and I'm not certain about this, but I seem to have recall hearing in the name of certain postkim that we can look at your aggregate purchases over a year. If each individual purchase to the grocery store and $100 here and $100 there and the total price difference might be only $5 or $10, I can afford that perhaps. But if I'm spending several thousand dollars on groceries during the year and it's a few hundred dollars difference, many people, that's a harder sell. So I have heard certain postkin will say that we don't have to look at each individual purchase, even if the whole grocery order together, we can look at the overall purchasing decision, whether to patronize which store, and make decisions like that. Again, though, the postkim are really not that clear. They don't give such concrete guidance for how to determine what's considered large or small. And at the end of the day, my takeaway from this discussion has always been that you should take the mitzvah seriously and that you should be aware this is what the Torah asks of you and expects of you. As to exactly how to make each individual decision, you need to consult your conscience and perhaps consult a rabbinic advisor, but it's going to be difficult to find. It's not like making tea on Shabbos where you're going to find, even in Chasam Mishpah, very often we do find exact and painstaking and precise rules. This is not, the way I understand it, a topic where you're going to find exact, precise rules. At the end of the day, it's going to be something of a judgment call. One of the interesting contemporary or near contemporary discussions of this is a tshuva in the Menchas Yitzchak by Diane Weiss. So he originally came from England, from Manchester, I think, the rest of his career in Eretz Yisrael. This tshuva actually was written, I'm not sure at what point in his career, but it was written to a rabbi in Brooklyn. It is about chain stores. Tes Shin Aleph Yud Nun, Samach Tes Ayin Resh. Basically, it's the classic situation where a chain store is moving into town. It is putting the mom and pop stores out of business. The chain stores were not typically Jewish. The mom and pop stores, at least some of them, are. Now, Rabbi Israel, a rabbi from Brooklyn, who was the one who posed the question to the Menchas Yitzchak, actually discusses the question of whether the big stores may have some Jewish ownership, discusses whether they're religious or not. That's a point we'll return to shortly. But the consensus, I think, is that even if there's some Jewish ownership, and again, any national corporation, any publicly held company is going to have some Jewish ownership. If not direct, it's going to have through broad-based stock mutual funds and so on. Everything has some Jewish ownership. So, but, you know, I think the halacha would be clear in a case like this. If it's not primarily Jewish, though, we treat that as non-Jewish for our purposes, even if somewhere, you know, there is some Jewish shareholder in the company. So the question was, you know, what's the story? Should Jews be frequenting these chain stores if it means putting pressure and even driving the small stores out of business? And again, he grapples with the question. He discusses whether the obligation to purchase from Jews applies even if the Jews are more expensive. How much more expensive? Do we use the share of shtus? He goes back and forth and doesn't really have, as I recall, a totally satisfying conclusion. He does invoke one additional doctrine, which is very important to this discussion. He does invoke one additional mitzvah, which the Chafetz Chaim also mentions in Avos Chesed, and that is a separate mitzvah. If you look at the Rambam in number 2, the Rambam has a famous list. He says there are eight hierarchical levels of tzedakah. The highest one, the ultimate one, which has above which nothing is, he says, is supporting a Jew and prevent him from becoming poor in the first place. Dealing with him in such a way that allows him to maintain an honorable standard of living, a way that enables him to support himself, and preventing him, forestalling him from becoming a pauper in the first place. That's the loftiest type of tzedakah possible. He gives various examples of what you would do. You would give him a gift sometimes, he says, lend him money if he needs it, get into partnership with him, like we would call investments, you know, investment funding. Or he says, mamtila malacha, give him work, give him a job in order to support him so that he shouldn't crash and become an indigent, become a beggar. He says this is derived from the biblical verse, v'hachzakta bo, you shall support him, meaning financially support him, and that doesn't mean supporting him after he's poor. The Rambam understands it to mean support him in business, support him in his economically productive endeavors in such a way, hachzik bo ad shlo yipol v'yitztarech, keep him self-sufficient so that he doesn't become poor. So Dayan Weiss, Menachas Yitzchak, as well as the Chafetz Chaim and other poskim have said, in addition to the general mitzvah to prefer Jews, and that applies even if the Jew is rich, and even if he doesn't need your business to stay afloat, the mitzvah to prefer Jews is a mitzvah in and of itself. Beyond that, he says, if it makes a difference between the Jew having a viable livelihood or not, then you have a secondary mitzvah of hachzaktabo. That's, you know, circumstantial. That depends on whether he's really in danger of going out of business or not. But in a case where he needs your patronage, where if not for your custom, he's really in danger of losing his livelihood and ending up without a means of support, then you have this tremendously exalted mitzvah of tzedakah, of giving him business to keep him afloat.
So if it's framed in the concept of tzedakah, you could almost see the argument where what Dayan Weiss would say, if it is more expensive, you could take that from Maser Ksafim or something like that.
That's an interesting argument. That is an interesting point. I don't recall if he makes that argument at all or not, but yeah, that would be an interesting argument. I don't know what he says about it, but that would be an interesting line of reasoning. So, we mentioned before, you mentioned quality, and I mentioned there are, you know, many other reasons we might have for preferring any one establishment or one provider over another. As I said, there isn't a whole lot of literature on this topic. One perhaps surprising or problematic, you know, counterintuitive statement on this is from the Maram Shik in number 11. Maram Shik was asked about tircha. Tircha means inconvenience or tediousness. It's a difficult word to translate directly into English. So he argues that tircha is not a factor. The fact that patronizing the Jew would cost you time or effort is not a consideration. He says even though he's referring to the fact that poskim have said that difference in price is a factor, convenience is not a factor. He has ringing words. He says, is it a small thing to support a Jew just because you find it not convenient? He says, what kind of svar is that? He says, the person is mechuyev to, you're not losing anything, he says. There's no out-of-pocket expense. It's just a little less convenient. And your friend benefits. It's bechlal gemilas chasadim, he says. How can you not want to be matriach? The Torah says, rodif tzedakah v'chesed, gimtza chayim v'tzedakah v'chavod v'hi Hashem imo. So this really leads to a paradox that has disturbed me for many years in Chashon Mishpat, in Jewish civil law, and that is the halacha in many areas places a higher significance on money, even when it's not a lot of money, than it does on time and convenience. even though we all have some trade-off between time, convenience, and money, whatever that trade-off is. So, for example, we've discussed, I think, once or twice, Hashavas Aveda, returning lost property. Mi'ikra Adin might not be the right thing to do, but Mi'ikra Adin, according to the strict halacha, a person has the right to say, if it's going to cost me money, if I'm going to come late to work, and I'll be docked, I make $15 an hour, I come an hour late to work because I'm returning the Aveda, I don't have to do it. I don't have to lose $15, even if the Aveda is very expensive, even if I see a diamond ring on the floor. If it's going to cost me $15 of dock pay, I don't have to do it, post can say. Now, obviously, if you can pick up the ring now and return after work, then you have to do that. But, you know, if going down and getting the ring now is going to make me miss my bus and I'm going to miss an hour of work, don't have to do it. You should, the post can say. And we discussed, you can charge the guy for the $15, then you should do it, then collect the $15 from him. But the principle is that you don't have to lose even relatively small amounts of money to help somebody else save his money. Avedas kakademus, your property comes first. However, if it's just a question of time or convenience, a person has to schlep. If a person's not working, it's his supper break, it's his day off, he has to take the Aveda, spend an hour and sweat and carry it and do whatever he has to do and make phone calls and hang up signs or whatever the halacha requires. So the general rule is, again, qualitatively, halacha does not require you to lose money, even relatively small amounts of money. You are required to expend effort and inconvenience. Now, again, we all have some conversion between time and money. And most of us are not, homo economicus, behavioral economics has shown most of us don't make these trade-offs in completely rigorous ways. Sometimes some of us will spend money to find something a dollar cheaper in a store, but we wouldn't, work for a half hour for a dollar per 5 minutes or whatever it is. Most of us, economics has come to realize we're not perfectly, rigorously, arithmetically correct economic actors. But in a broad sense, we all have some trade-off between time and money. Most of us, let's say, would, if I tell you, here, do this for me for 10 minutes and I'll pay you $1,000, we would do it generally. If you told me, do this for 3 hours and I'll give you $1.50, most of us wouldn't do it. So at the end of the day, there is some kind of, generally speaking, conversion ratio between time and convenience, tircha, in other words, and money. Yet, halacha doesn't really acknowledge that. Halacha says money out of pocket, or even lost revenue, if I have to take off from work, that's also considered money for these purposes, is a factor. Time and convenience is not. So the Maram Sheikh is making a similar point with regard to preferring Jews. He says, if the Jew is cheaper, significantly cheaper, then there may be a heter. If the non-Jew is cheaper, you may have a heter to go to the non-Jew, but if it's just more convenient, then you don't. He doesn't get into the fact that how much inconvenience. If it's a half hour driving and it's 15 minutes looking for parking and listening to horns on the whole time and surly clerks or whatever, he doesn't get into that. But he just says, tircha, you have to do, money, you don't have to do, and he doesn't really acknowledge this kind of paradox.
It assumes that you have discretionary time.
Sorry.
Discretionary time, just like you can have discretionary money, spend it however you wish. It assumes that the person has discretionary time. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes. So again, if the time is time from work, then that's considered money. That time is money. The poskim don't discuss if the time is bedtime, if the time is your wife is going to get angry if you don't come home. So shalom bayis, these types of things the poskim don't discuss. But yes, the general assumption is there are two kinds of time. There's time that yields money, and that's equivalent to money, and there's time that not necessary for money. Obviously, if you need time to eat, otherwise you'll be malnourished and you have to go to the hospital, and that's necessary also. But the point is, halakha generally assumes that beyond what you need to make a living, the rest of the time is discretionary. We actually discussed what happens if you're learning Torah. Should you abandon your chavrusa to return lost property? That's actually, poskim generally say yes.
So I'm just thinking also of a scenario that would not necessarily, a man would not necessarily think of, which is you have, a woman rushing home to her children, and the one store would be one-stop shopping, and very often the Jewish store would mean you have to go to two stores.
Right.
So that's not, mm-hmm. I mean, I understand it's convenience, but it's not like a spoiling, a spoiled type of convenience.
Right, and you're right. The language of the Maram Sheikh that I read refers to the tircha as just, laziness and self-indulgence. And you're right. So very often a woman certainly understands that, and men understand it too, I think, that time is precious, and every minute of time that you're doing on something means a minute of time that you're not doing on something else. And certainly for people who use their time well, it could be learning Torah, it can be being with your family, it can be helping a spouse, it can be helping a kid. There are a lot of things it can do. Yes, as I said, the poskim, there isn't really much discussion on this. There's one or two later authorities which I don't have in the sources here, But the discussion is not that satisfying. And again, you know, the risk of sounding like a lightweight, I'm just going to say that in this particular issue, I think at the end of the day, it's left to some extent, it's going to be a judgment call. I think the postgames don't really give, you know, rigidly applicable rules. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be some, you have to be aware the Torah considers it a significant mitzvah to patronize a Jew, and you have to weigh that against other factors. If your kids are going to be cranky because you haven't spent any time with them and you haven't taken care of them, that's a factor too. You have responsibilities to your children too, either spouse. So, you know, all these things are factors. And I agree with you that these things are important. I agree with you that we should distinguish between time not spent, you know, reading a book and time not spent being with your family or doing other things that are valuable. And again, I know it's frustrating, but I don't have rigid rules, but this is just some of the framework that Post can deal with.
I sort of, when you started the thing, I actually assumed, like, what the Chavetz Chaim and what you were saying, like you ended up saying later on with the Rambam and Tzedakah. I assume that this whole reason was that you're supposed to help your Chaver, your family. He's trying to struggle, but you said that even if they're wealthy, you
yes.
have this.
That idea is similar to Hashavas Aveda. The idea is that Jews are expected to behave in certain ways toward fellow Jews, like returning lost property, even if he's Rothschild. He doesn't need it. He has other Avedas, but it's an Aveda. It's a mitzvah to, it's not Gzela, walking by without taking it. I wouldn't be stealing anything.
If all things are equal and Rothschild has a store and, you know, Giant has a store, okay, fine, but let's say Rothschild's overcharging and
So a couple of things about this. So first of all, overcharging is a loaded term. There are poskim who say that if the Jew is pricing unfairly or taking advantage, now, the problem is economically, it's very difficult to assign meaning to terms like that. Now, if he explicitly is charging more because of this halacha, poskins don't seem to like that. If he's charging more because he knows that the Torah is going to require you to patronize him, that seems to be a problem. Poskins don't like that. The Chavetz Chaim himself says, I don't think I have the language here, but he says that if he's he uses, again, very, you know, general terms. If he's charging an unfair price, if the correct price, he says, if the, you know, general and fair price is what the non-Jew is charging and the Israel is charging an unfair price, there's no mitzvah to give him your business if the price he's charging is not legitimate. But in a case where it's not wrong, it's just that he's a smaller store and he and his economies of scale are less and his rent might be higher and whatever the reasons are, then it's not a wrong price, it's just a different price. So in such a case, then that's where the postgame seems to assume that even if he's reasonably well off, there is a mitzvah to patronize him. Now, again, if he's really rich and he's not even going to notice the difference, and for you it's a big deal, that I think falls into the general category that I'm saying, that the postgame do, I think, give some leeway for judgment calls. But yeah, it is difficult. But it is true, the postgame do say that it's independent of his being rich or poor. The basic mitzvah, well, again, all else being equal, the basic mitzvah is to support him, even if it's to give him the business, even if it'll be more expensive. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a gemara in the beginning of Brachos, which I remember only because I was wondering with Daniel, with the trade-offs on the issue of Hashavas Aveda. So if the loss, this halamta may happen, so under some circumstances, it gives you an out. You can pretend you don't see the Aveda or the mitzvah because, you know, your loss will be greater than his gain. And
right.
A couple of other circumstances.
Right. So
those trade-offs are...
Right, so I alluded to that before. There are basically two categories of trade-offs. One of them is financial, where your financial loss will be greater than his, or your even if it won't be greater, if it's an unreimbursed loss, even if it's smaller, then you have no obligation. The other one is personal dignity. If it's if it'll be embarrassing or awkward for you to do it, so those trade-offs are built in. Now, here the postman was saying that in general, many postmen are saying we don't have those trade-offs. Now, not in every mitzvah do we have the same trade-offs. So, right, but you're right. Hashavas Aveda, there are certain trade-offs built in. And those trade-offs, there's some debate about whether and how they apply to this particular mitzvah. I just want to cover one last topic just briefly. That is the question of how we deal with non-religious Jews. So this came up, Rabbi Walter showed me some literature about this. This came up in the 30s. Avodah Ivrit, the question about, you know, Paul Agudas Yisrael wanted the Yishuv to hire exclusively Jews and not Arabs. They needed the business and other reasons, security obviously, but we're discussing the economic angle now. What is the obligation of a Jewish employer to hire Jewish labor? So there were a number of different issues involved, and some of them obviously are beyond the scope of this talk, but just keeping to the technical issues, one of the issues that came up was the idea that the Jews who were being hired were not necessarily Torah observant Jews. So does the mitzvah to prefer Jews still apply to such Jews? So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, in a letter, seemed to argue that it does not. He argued that, like many mitzvahs in the Torah, you can't steal from non-Jews, but like many mitzvahs in the Torah, there are privileges, like returning an aveda or not charging interest. These types of laws, they do not generally apply. The ones that don't apply to non-Jews often don't apply to irreligious Jews either. So Rav Elchanan seems to have felt they do not apply to non-Jews. And the truth is, there are many earlier sources that say the same thing. You look in the Chasam Sofer, for example, in number 7. He also says, in general, Chazal interpret Amisecha to mean Am She'itcha, Im She'itcha, Betaru, Mitzvahs, and that someone who's a non-observant Jew wouldn't have this halacha.
It applies to ribbis?
This particular halacha, no, it does not, as you said, right? We forbid ribbis, but certain halachas, like Hashavas Aveda, and certain other ones, right, ribbis was a misstatement.
We're talking about a mumar. He's talking about someone who's doing it like...
Right, so now he's talking about a mumar, and the question then becomes, what about a tino shenishba? What about the contemporary categories of non-observant who are often treated less stringently than the real mumar of the early poskim? There is some debate about that. I don't have all the sources written down. Nevertheless, there are a number of poskim who feel that with this particular privilege of being preferred, which is not so intuitive anyway, preferring a Jew, there are poskim who say that it does not apply to a non-religious Jew. Rav Elchanan Wasserman seems to have felt that way. The Chazon Ish did not agree. The Chazon Ish seems to have felt that no, if they are, that he made an interesting argument. He said, even if it's true that due to their irreligious status, they would forfeit the privileges, the special treatment the Torah gives to them, but they have families. And he says, the children are children. He says, children are innocent. He says, you have no right to, we're responsible for the children too. So I saw this recently. This is in line with something I saw many years ago, one of my favorite stories. The Rav Moshe Sternbach, who is an Eda Charedis, you know, hardliner, and no one's going to accuse him of being a softy on these issues, he quotes a story of the Chabina Rav. Chabina Rav was once asked, he says, about an industrialist, a Jewish industrialist,